For the taping audience, it is 4:30 p.m. on April 9th. Is that correct? All right. Good audience participation. We are in UMC East Ballroom. I am the moderator. My name is John Tare. I am the president and CEO of the Boulder Chamber. This is the Conference of World Affairs Roundtable Discussion. We call it panel number 1603. And it's titled, A Digital Revolution, Information Wants to Be Free. Okay? Usually at this point, I will give a little introduction to what might be the focus for the conversation. We had a little confab before, and it was clear that we have no idea where this conversation is going. Okay? So what I'm going to do, and it's a relatively short time frame that we have. We only go until 5:30. So we want to give the panelists a good opportunity to say some quick opening remarks, and then in roundtable fashion, we will introduce a topic, give them a chance to have a dialogue, and you may not hear from me again until about 20 minutes to go. We will then start to take audience questions. We also have computer questions that we may be receiving as well. So if you're thinking about calculating the time frame for the dialogue. So I'm just going to run right into this, and I'm going to introduce each one individually before they speak. So we're going to start with Barrett Anderson. Barrett Anderson is the director of Programs for FIRE 2018. She is the CEO and editor-in-chief of Scout.ai, a media company exploring the future of technology through analysis, science fiction, and scenario planning games. She has no idea about technology, I'm sensing. In 2017, her work on information warfare was featured in The New Yorker, Gizmodo, and TechCrunch, and is cited by the internet creator Tim Berners-Lee as one of the top three challenges facing the internet. Barrett, where do you go with this topic?
All right, well thank you. It's great to be here with all of you. I thought a lot about data ownership and open data generally. And I think one of the things that people kind of miss when they're talking about big data in general is just the real problem is not whether data is open or closed, but the real problem is that the data that we personally generate is not owned by us. We have no control over who uses it, over who for what. And we have no way to revoke that data if they're doing something with it that we disagree with. So a lot of these companies out there who are collecting data, they have generally terms of agreement, right? And in those terms of agreement, you're checking, anytime you check that little box, you're saying, hey, I give you permission to use any data about me for your business purposes. So I want to just do a quick show of hands. How many of you guys have actually read the terms of services that you checked off in the last 2 weeks? A couple of you. Good. We have a pretty informed audience in here. That's great. About four. So,
relative.
And I think, so the real problem when I think about big data is not just, it's a couple of things. We don't have a way to revoke and or to give control of our data or to profit from the use of our personal data. But the other thing is that companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook really have become data monopolists, right? And so they present themselves as being a company, for example, Amazon presents itself as being a company that is an online marketplace, and it is. But the real benefit and the real competitive advantage that you have as a company like Amazon is actually how much data you have. And so essentially what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is all of these companies hoovering up as much data as they possibly can, and using that to help build more efficiencies into their products, become smarter, be more targeted towards you and all of their other users. But that is something, and you know, to be honest, that's been completely unregulated. In a way, that's not really their fault, because there are no regulations to limit that. But it's something that I think we need to begin to address as a society. So that's kind of where I stand on this.
Great, Barrett. And so that's one area of focus for today. William, see where you're going with this. William Hertling is a writer and web strategist programmer. His award-winning Singularity series, starting with Avogadro Corp., explores the emergence of artificial intelligence, coexistence of humans and smart machines, and the impact of social reputation, technological unemployment, and other near-future issues. His novels, Kill Process and Kill Switch, are techno-thrillers exploring data ownership, privacy, trust, and personal freedom, required reading in the U.S. Air Force's Future Combat Strategy course. Where does that take us?
Thanks. Well, what I would say is that one of the differences with data collection today is that we really don't have the option to opt out of it. So if you were to look just at social media, for example, that's where all of our friends and family are, right? And historically, one of the biggest punishments anybody, any society could give to anybody would be to banish them, to ostracize them, to separate them from their friends and family. So what does it take to leave social media? It means leaving behind all of your relationships. So it's an almost impossible step for most people to take. That's just one of the conduits of ways that data is being collected about us. You're purchasing information, purchasing things online, purchasing things with credit cards. This is how the majority of our purchasing happens. Again, almost impossible to opt out of. Not totally impossible, but you'd have to take heroic steps to do so. Cory Doctorow, one of my favorite writers, talks about privacy as being akin to safe drinking water. So, you know, it's possible for someone to collect rainwater, hold it in a cistern, purify it, and then have their own safe drinking water supply. But that's a very expensive way to do it, and then only people who have the wealth and the means to collect the water will actually have safe water. Or we can say, hey, that's a job of the government to give us safe drinking water, and now everybody has it, and the cost to us as a society is far lower because we've centralized that. And similarly with privacy, yes, you could take these heroic steps to kind of try to stay out of everybody's Hoover, but it's just not reasonable for most people to do. And so we really need some legislation of privacy, of the right to own our own data and control who accesses it and be able to revoke that.
Wonderful. Okay. All right. Yet another speaker on this topic. He's using the digital technology as we speak. Brandon Anderson. Brandon is a human rights activist, 2019 TED Fellow, a military veteran, and the founder and CEO of Rahim Al, a tech nonprofit working to end police violence through data collection, storytelling, and organizing. Anderson and his team are eliminating barriers to reporting police misconduct with an artificial intelligence-powered chatbot named Rahim, which collects stories, good and bad, about police encounters and uses the crowdsourcing data to advance policies to end police violence. Brandon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
How y'all doing today? Yeah, it's good to be here. So it's really hard to follow the previous speakers because I'm going to talk about the lack of data that exists and not necessarily the fulfillment and overflow of data for a particular subject. And I'll start by kind of situating the problem. In the United States, there are about 18,000 police departments, each with their own unique, often complicated process for reporting police misconduct. Now, we might think that having each of these be different makes sense because they're not all the same. It's 18,000 police departments. But this decentralized nature in the reporting process for police misconduct really presents two fundamental challenges to reform. One is that the country cannot apply best practices at scale because police data is locked away in a single department. Second, police officers are able to navigate and roam from department to department without their records ever following them. Right? And so first and foremost, we have to create an independent service for reporting police misconduct in the United States that is a centralized location where data can be shared about how communities experience and are impacted by police. And that's what Rahim is, an independent service for reporting police conduct in the United States. So my first and foremost job is to actually increase the amount of data that exists in the world that is posited by the lived experiences of real people and their interactions with police. I would say that, secondly, police departments already have a ton of data about you and your life and how you engage with the rest of the world already. And so all of that data is normally informing their decisions around public safety. And so Rahim's job, my company, the job of Rahim, is to ensure that those policies, either procedural policies that govern police performance or the policies that enact public safety measures, are not only accounted for through the data collection that the government does, but also are influenced by our experiences such that they make up a more robust human-centered opportunity for us to thrive in a safe environment.
So moving from risk of data collection to use and the benefits. So now, Alexander Bard. Alexander is a philosopher and futurologist based in Stockholm, Sweden. Easy to say. He is the author of not one, but five books. The Netrocrats, The Global Empire, The Body Machines, Synthetism, thank you. Creating God in the Internet Age and Digital Libido, Sex, Power, and the Violence in the Network Society, all with his co-writer, Jan Söderqvist.
Söderqvist.
Thank you. Yeah. But want to make sure he gets appropriate credit. Bard has also enjoyed a highly successful 25-year career as a producer and artist in the international music industry. And he is a celebrity in his native Sweden as the toughest judge on the TV shows Swedish Idol and Sweden's Got Talent. Take it away, Alex.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm a philosopher. I work with digital. I've done it for the past 25 years. I'm increasingly working in North America, and I'll tell you why. You probably have a laugh when I'll tell you. Silicon Valley has finally discovered that they don't get it. So they're now searching for the very few people out there who probably got it right in the last 30 years because they had a deeper understanding of what's going on. And I'll tell you the number one thing Silicon Valley doesn't get, they don't get human beings. Because Silicon Valley is full of 25-year-old autists who don't know how to build proper customer service to begin with. So they're like in a deep crisis. But I want to take this whole issue of information wants to be free. It's like a 20-year-old saying, so we can skip that. Information will, from now on, always be remembered. The thing about digital is that it hasn't even started yet. It's going to start in the 2020s. That's what we're doing all the wrong things right now. It's all children's diseases. The current Facebook crisis is well-deserved, an example of that. Digital is going to hit us in the 2020s. And what's going to be totally new in history is that everything we've ever done will from now on be remembered and stored somewhere. And don't even dream about getting away from that. There's no way to get away from that. So I want to take the vision here, a couple of minutes after introduction, to take us away from America for a while, thank you, and go to China, and then look at the biggest institution in the world when it comes to data collection. Believe me, it's not Google. It's called the Chinese Communist Party. Okay? The Chinese Communist Party are now collecting data about every human being on the planet. Massive amounts of data. No wonder we're closing down Huawei and we're building 5G in America. You know, you should. Okay, because all the data in China goes strictly to the Chinese Communist Party. And they've discovered that if they only have a few data points about a human being, like, I'm a 58-year-old, nasty, old, dirty uncle living in Stockholm, Sweden. There's quite a few men like me in the world, believe me or not, okay? So if you found enough of men like me and get enough data about them, you can predict everything I'm going to do. You're going to predict every thought I'm going to have. And this nightmare is called sensocracy. It's a whole new political concept. This is the concept that's driving the Chinese Communist Party today, because it's a one-party state, and everybody's involved with the Chinese Communist Party want the party to stay in power. That means that every member of that party has an incentive to increase sensocracy, to start within China, and they export it around the world. Sensocracy means that they don't need my personal data. To fight to keep my personal data is already a redundant struggle. They will have enough data to pinpoint me so they can find out that my mind is going somewhere where they don't like, so they can hit me and strike me and get me out of the system. You're discovering it in China already today. I have friends now in Shanghai who can't even go online and buy a regular flight ticket because they don't know where it comes from, but suddenly they're not allowed to buy a flight ticket because the social credit is so low, because they have ideas of their own, like autonomy and independence. So now imagine, this is what the Chinese Communist Party are doing. This is the dream of the Californian tech giants. These companies are not run by empathy. They're run by mathematicians with tons of autism in their systems, right? They're not run by human beings to begin with. So the problem they have in Silicon Valley is that they're all tiny Chinese Communist parties. That's what these tech giants are. That's what we're up against. And I think what I'm working with in Europe is, we started a pirate party in Europe. That was not an American mention. What we did in Europe, after all, some 15 years ago, was we were not naive about the internet, and we realized that we're going to have a long struggle ahead of us to fight for our freedom and autonomy. And that's not controlling my own data. That's more like creating an environment where these tech giants get tons of competition, where the Chinese Communist Party is held responsible, at least outside of China, for what it's doing. Meaning we're building decentralized platforms, open source and everything. And the challenge we're up to now is a very, very grounded one. It's more like these tech giants are employing tons of mathematicians and programmers and pay them really great amounts of money. And the kind of work we have to do now is more spiritual. It's like, who wants to be a programmer or a coder, build decentralized platforms, work with open source without getting paid for it? Any 25-year-old I can find today with that attitude, I adopt them instantly. Because they're going to be the real heroes of the future. Because I think we need to just look at it like we need competition so that you and I can decide to use encrypted platforms instead of going to Facebook when we communicate with other human beings. That's the kind of work I do.
I knew this topic would freak me out. Okay, Greg, save us. Greg Mahawald. Do I have
Mahold?
Mahold.
Yeah.
Greg is a senior computer vision engineer at Uber, developing precise 3D models of cities from street level to imaginary. Right?
Imagery.
These 3D maps are generated from a very large number of images and can enable many use cases for Uber's riders and drivers, including pinpoint localization, enhanced navigation, and interactive virtual guidance. Exciting stuff. Greg.
So, hello, everyone. I'm the local representative. I'm just down the road here in Louisville. I do work for Uber. I'm a computer vision researcher by background, and I guess I would kind of frame this by drawing a corollary to what we're doing with images versus personal data. So we're not collecting personal data, but we build these highly detailed 3D maps of the cities around the world with huge amounts of imagery, billions of images that Uber has gone and collected. So it's not user-generated yet, but these 3D models, you can imagine, you have your phone, you overlay these 3D models on the real world, and you can do lots of interesting things. So you take an image, and it localizes you, and through your camera, you can view this digital overlay that we draw a line on the ground for you to find your car. But, you know, you go beyond Uber, you know, this digital world is an augmented reality for everybody that can view through their phone. So where does big data come in? Well, we use massive amounts of data, as I mentioned, to build these models. And you look forward a couple of years, let's say these models are built, we have these awesome digital experiences in the world. Somebody takes an image and they, you know, it might be fair to say, hey, could we use that imagery to update our map? And they might say yes, but you know, if you, any reasonable person, if you said, hey, can I use that image to track the people that happen to be in it? Most people would probably say no. So I think there's a real crisis there in a corollary of personal information of you have, as mentioned, it's really hard to know where that goes. Before I was at Uber, I worked at a medical device startup, and I kind of think about this problem in the terms of informed consent. Informed consent takes three things. Number one, the user that's consenting must know what they're consenting to and be able to understand what they're consenting to. And I think there's a real education crisis in people knowing what they're consenting to, number one. Number two, the scope of that consent has to be well-defined. And that scope often is not defined in current consents. And number three, there has to be trust. So you have to trust the receiver of that data to keep within the scope of that consent. So I think we fail on all fronts right now in the technology age compared to medical in terms, if you frame it in terms of informed consent. And I think trust, as has been mentioned, there's been ample examples in previous years about how Silicon Valley, if you want to call it that, or technology giants need to do a lot better in gaining people's trust, because the data in the right form, I think, can be valuable as somebody who is using this big data and can enable these experiences going forward in the right framework. Using those images would be great, but obviously only within the consent that people allow.
Okay. Great. Wow. Very full spectrum dialogue here, just in the introduction. Opportunities for using data in a positive way for society, and then a lot of conversation about the risks and the lack of control of the information that's collected through the digital engagement. So this is my opportunity to strike the match, let the fire roll here, and I'm just going to hit it off with, some of you have laid out, I'd say, somewhat of a apocalyptic image of the future, but let me just ask it straight up. Digital revolution, should we welcome it and embrace it? Should we fear it? And is there a way to control it? Please.
Okay, number one, please don't think political regulation. Okay, politicians don't get anything. They just get in the way, they make it worse. Don't think regulation is going to save anything. So we can kill socialism there. Okay, the other thing I want to kill right now in the room is something Americans love. It's your own state religion. It's called individualism. You love the individuals. You all bought into René Descartes' I think, therefore I am, starting in 1632. That's the real American religion. The individual is dead, okay? Digital killed him, or her, or it, okay? It's gone. We are now all individuals, meaning we're all building networks of people. That means I would recommend that if you're going to go into digital and get the benefits out of it and fight the negative sides, build your own network of people, build your own tribe, build a subculture of people, make them aware of the situation, and do this in groups of people. And America can do that. You've got a beautiful word in the American English language called community. There's another great word coming from the world of theology called congregation. I constantly use these terms, congregations and community. Build a community of people online the way you do physically, like the city of Boulder. Build a digital community like that of people who are like-minded, want to fight for freedom, encryption, you know, autonomy, things like that. But don't ever believe we can construct something where the individual alone against the tech giant has a single chance. That we all know, and the overwhelming amount of information we have to agree with if you're going to do anything in this society makes it impossible for an individual to do that. So I'm all about tribal from now on.
Mm-hmm. Anyone want to take that on?
So I have been having a lot of conversations about this recently. And in regard to your comment about Silicon Valley is a lot of just mini communist parties, I think you're absolutely right about China and their surveillance and their gathering of data, which is terrifying. In particular because within the Communist Party, there's no room for anyone who disagrees with Xi Jinping, right? So anyone who has disagreed with him in the past has already been ejected from the party. Anyone who disagrees with him who is a Chinese citizen is, you know, there's a lawyer actually who was sent to jail because he referred to Xi as a steamed bun Xi in a private WeChat message, which is essentially like Facebook Messenger, right? So he was sent to jail, his lawyer was disbarred for trying to represent him in China, right? So that is the thing, the kind of thing we're up against. I would say that there is an interesting thing going on in the United States where Silicon Valley is really, I think, a little bit more complex than that, where it's really driven by capitalism. And
they are listening.
They're listening. I was about to get to the good part.
Exactly.
So because Silicon Valley is so beholden to the market and quarterly cycles and the cycles of capitalism, their religion is efficiency, right? And every quarter they're trying to make their companies more and more and more and more efficient. I would say the what that means is that they are trying to get better and better and better at collecting data, and they're trying to do that as cheaply as possible. But there's a bright spot in Silicon Valley, and that is the employees of those tech companies. Because in the capitalistic system, you need to, as a tech company, if you want to get ahead and stay ahead, you have to be able to attract and retain talent. That is the greatest, I would say that's the greatest, whatever it's called, I'm not something, shortage. Yeah, that, and it's the greatest asset that you have as a tech company, right? Is like that combined with your strategy. So one of the things that I have been seeing more recently is, and I tell this to people frequently when I speak internationally about information warfare, because they all want to know what can we do to change these companies. And one of the best strategies to actually create change within a tech company is to talk to people who work for those tech companies and tell them that they actually can do something. There's a group at Amazon in Seattle right now that's passing, has a shareholder resolution on the ballot to try to get them to be more sustainable, right, in their packaging. And they've actually, I have a friend who's involved in this, they actually just pressured them into releasing their sustainability plan early that they've been working on for a long time. So you actually, as an employee or a piece of talent in one of these companies, you can actually have a significant impact. Because there are two things they fear. One, losing talent, and two, looking terrible in the press. Right, and I think that on top of that, I actually disagree with what you said about policy, because policy actually has been effective. But the trick is the policy has to actually match the scale of the company, right? If you're slapping a $10 million fine on Facebook anytime they violate data standards, they're going to ignore that. They're going to ignore that policy because to them it's way more worthwhile, the benefit that they're going to get from ignoring that data standard, than it is for them to pay $10 million if and when they maybe get caught, and probably they won't, and like who's really going to prosecute that, because it's going to take a long time, right? So the policies that I have seen work both here and in Europe are policies that are very smart about, they're leveraging big penalties for companies that aren't standing up to policy. So they said.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add on the employees. I mean, Google just overthrew their AI oversight board before it got started internally. Because of concerns about unfairness and who made up the board. And I also think it's interesting, coming up through, you know, top university, computer science, my whole life, I've never taken ethics. You know, that's other something to think about. At a university, you know, these programmers are asked to build and develop these systems and use this data in a way that, you know, do they pause to think about, you know, what the ethical ramifications are, and do they have the tools to do that? So, you know, from an educational perspective, a computer science major, you know, often may not have the tools to understand exactly what's going on. And I think they're waking up to that. But.
I'm going to explore this topic just a little bit more, dive deeper into the notion of the risk and how we control. So, William, maybe just if you had anything to offer, just you laid out some challenges that we face in the control of data. What is the opportunity for us to maintain the ownership or to recapture control of the data that we put out there?
Yeah, there's a group that inspires me. They're basically a bunch of web programmers under the umbrella of IndieWeb, and they've been working for the past several years to basically replicate the kinds of features of social media through open extensions to the web, so that anybody could create a website, host and own their own information there, publish that information, but have it be interactive and interoperate with existing sites like Twitter and Facebook, and be able to comment on each other's feeds. So they're kind of bootstrapping from the bottom up, like all of the functionality that we expect in these closed silo systems, only with personal ownership of the data. Which, you know, at least means you get to own your data, you get to, you know, that other people aren't, you know, there's this other tendency with data, which is things get shut down, right? I remember a conversation about this a long time ago that was by a bunch of cultural anthropologists that were talking about losing GeoCities and how there was this rich, GeoCities, for people who aren't familiar with it, was web pages that were hosted by company called GeoCities, super long time ago, I think bought by Yahoo. But they were around for quite a while. A lot of web content was published there. And then they were just shut down, and it just disappeared from the web. And the anthropologists were saying, this was our record of this particular period of time. For these 5 years, these 10 years, whatever it was, we knew what people were doing, what they were interested in, what the social issues were at the time. It was a data source that we all had access to. And then it was shut down for monetary reasons. And then we just lose that history. And that can happen with any of our digital assets. So there's a reason to own it just to prevent the loss of it and to have some control over it. On the other side of it, besides the personal level, on the aggregate level, there is this monopolistic benefit to owning the data. When Amazon has all the data, they benefit from it. When Google has the data, they benefit from it. And we like those benefits. Like, we like smarter search. We like better driving directions. But do we want to further the monopolistic power of the companies that have this data? Or do we want it to be available in some way so that everybody can benefit from it? And so by owning our own data and choosing to allow it to go out into the world in an aggregate fashion that is open and accessible to anybody, then we're actually reducing some of the monopoly power.
Sorry, Alexander.
I'm so happy. I thought I was the only Marxist on this panel. It turns out you're all Marxists. Okay, good, great. The union is coming back in a big way. There we go. You're more Marxist than me, Bert. Okay, have you heard of Dropbox? Okay, data is not lost anymore. That was a typical children's disease we had in the beginning. So all data, we should expect all data from now on to always be remembered somewhere. So that's not a problem any longer. Those problems are over and done with. But I would say, if we look at the internet today, two great things. One of them I teach all my students is Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a communist project that started in Europe. Can you believe anything more un-Californian than that? Hmm. It's been successful so far. When you think of having access to your smartphone in your pocket and all the wisdom of the world, the first thing you probably think about is Wikipedia. And it's created by people. Google tried to make a commercial version of it and pay people to be Wikipedians. It failed. So apparently there's something about people that's not Burning Man where they actually do stuff they're not getting paid for, even Americans, okay? Wikipedia is a good thing. The other thing, the key word here is algorithm. We're going to have a war over the algorithms. And if the algorithm is kept clean, meaning if the algorithm is based completely on attentionalist mathematics, I'll describe what that is. Attentionalist mathematics is that your behavior is what's being tracked, how long you stay in a website, whether you use its functions, what kind of grades you give to it, whether you turn to it, whether you recommend it to your friends. You know, the principles that, for example, Uber are brilliantly based on. So the algorithm, if that's kept clean, if I search a word, for example, and I really get access to the best quality in the world of whatever I'm searching, and whatever that is, then that's actually against the big giants. Because if the big giants start to misbehave, the first thing that's going to happen with the algorithm is going to point to their misbehavior. So they get a dirty name. That's why they're scared of newspapers today. They're going to get even more scared of their own algorithms. But if the algorithms get manipulated, and this is the thing about, you know, Google at least pretends so far that the ad is something different from the algorithm. And we all go to the algorithm, we don't buy into the ads. Essentially, the guy who puts an ad at Google search is desperate because he's failed at creating quality. So he throws money at his problem and he creates an ad. And we hate advertising. It's called spam online, right? Marketing is dead and over, or at least should be dead and over by now, because the algorithms will always point us to the people we want to get access to and have connections with that give us the best possible quality. That means the focus should be number one on quality, 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 and number two on transparency. If you go for quality and transparency, you'll be the winner of the algorithm in whatever you do, if you're best at what you do, right? So the algorithms have to be kept clean. So what I want to be really, really certain of the next few years is that Google search stops being so dominating. We can get more search engines out there. They're not that expensive to build, so that we can use other search engines so we can always be guaranteed we have access to clean algorithms that are not polluted by marketing. I think that's absolutely key, because then we're going to force these tech giants and the communist parties down on their feet.
You know, I wanted to bring Brandon in this conversation, and so we have talked so much about the fear and the potential consequences of ownership of data, but yet your work in the police practices is about using data to create best practices, et cetera, and that means collecting aggregate data. Wondering what your response is to this conversation.
Oh, I mean, it's great.
even in the context of the way that police use our data, is still pretty remarkably disastrous. If we're thinking about Amazon, there's been a sort of corridor out of Jeff Bezos's SpaceX navigation type deal, and he's seeking government contracts for Recognition, which is Amazon's facial recognition software that allows Immigration Customs Enforcement to track and locate undocumented immigrants and to throw them in jail and to deport them. And so you have a tech giant who has access to technology that allows him to that allows that giant to use its technology against us and against vulnerable populations, particularly who are being policed. If you extend that even beyond the Immigration Customs Enforcement, police departments now in the state of Oregon and Florida use facial recognition to track and locate people. And I'd say, I don't like that. I don't know if y'all do, but I don't. And it was particularly used in about 12 other states, Colorado being one of them, to track and locate protesters of color during particular points in time and to label them black extremists, of which the FBI and 45 has labeled really important to take down. So we've definitely seen the advent of technology be used against us in collaboration with data that should be ours. But there's another part of that that we're not talking about, because that has a lot to do with fear, quite frankly. When communities experience police violence, they don't talk about it. And if they do talk about it, it's in the living room of their parents' home. It's on the phone after they get stopped or pulled over, or while they're being pulled over. And it's oftentimes, in fact, 93% of people who experience police violence never report it. Right? People in the United States interact with police nearly 63 million times. That's 1.2 million times a week. Right now, in the span of this panel, there have been more than 500,000 people who have been stopped and pulled over by police. A fraction of those people are probably enduring violence as we speak, right? And less than 7% of them report that violence. And so if we don't have information that details how communities are being violently attacked by those of whom should be protecting us, we lose out on a number of things. One, we can't make evidence-based policies that are dictated and driven through the lived experiences of people, because we don't have information about how those experiences have impacted us, right? So policymaking at that point becomes just something that police departments and city governments just design on their own without the input of communities. And then when we're talking about the structural policies that government that govern the agencies of police, those are also non-existent, because we don't talk about how those police officers harass especially communities of color, kill people with whom have mental illnesses, and enact fines and fees on communities of color that for the last 2 years have accumulated more than 50% of more than 30 of the police department, more than 30 states who own police departments. Let me say that more more specifically, and I'll give you a good example. In Ferguson, Missouri, the police department and the mayor increased their fines and fees on black and brown communities to compensate for a 7% tax fall in the budget. Now, more than 30% of the general operating budget comes from communities of color, right? But we didn't really know that because people weren't talking about the number of fees that we were getting.
Yeah.
So we only learned that once people started to report that they were getting an increase in fines and fees. And so while I think leaving room for the fact that while it's important for us to talk about how we use data, there's also the type of data that just isn't being collected.
Yeah. So I do want to bring Greg into this as well, because so you're talking about both the flip side, the risk, and but yet so critical to have that data to help drive a policy decision and change. So, Greg, you work with data in your activity and your business model. So how do you respond to all these folks who are looking at you to use data responsibly?
Yeah, and I think I've heard both on the panel today that policy can work and they can't. I think there definitely needs to be room for policy. Take the facial recognition, for example, like not supporting Amazon in any way there, but as a computer vision researcher, I know of 5-6 open source software components out there that anyone could build a facial recognition system now. Not only is the data out there, the software is out there too. So there needs to be some policy aspects, around the technology in order for this to all work. Fighting technology purely with technology is not always, it could be a zero sum game. So in that respect, policy is welcomed. At Uber, again, I don't work with our user data, so I can't comment on that. But from an imagery perspective, once we get to the point of using user-generated data, GDPR has had a big impact internally, and we've used that across the board because not only we operate in Europe, but it's a good idea to do it everywhere. So I think policy is and can be an answer.
Okay. So we're going to have...
Can we go back to the police for 1 minute?
Okay, please. And I know Alex
I, in researching my novel Kill Process, one of the main subplots of the book is around domestic violence. And one of the statistics, so it's about domestic violence and it's about data access and the abuse of data to manipulate people. It turns out that 40% of households with a police officer in it have domestic violence in the house. 40%. So this is not like a few bad apples. This is a systematic problem. And then these are the people who have access to your data. So when and there's been numerous cases of police officers then using their data to track their abused partners, to keep tabs on them, to keep track of them as they try to lose their abusers in the system. So it's a huge issue, and we have no controls around it, right? It should be a fundamental thing. We should know who's tracking whom, and we don't have that level of control or oversight.
I think it's important to call out here that I think we're actually talking about two different kinds of data, right? So there's private data, what I would call private data, which is like data about you, could be your health records, could be your genomics, could be your personal payment, things you've purchased. And then there's public data. And public data includes things like how are the services that taxpayers are paying for performing, right? How are they actually, and I would put police data into that bucket. And public data, I think, is actually a very different animal as far as, we actually want probably more public data, right? And there's actually a lot that we can do with that additional public data about how civil servants are performing or how agencies are functioning or how traffic is moving through a city or which communities are being disproportionately affected by police violence. But that's a whole bucket that I would say is like a very different, needs a very different response. Mm-hmm. And actually we benefit from having often more of that, as opposed to private data, which is a completely different thing, and which allows, for example, someone to track their partner who's been abused. But I think it's really important that we kind of like name those two categories, because it's problematic to talk about them interchangeably, I would say.
I know that Alex wanted to offer something else. Please.
Bigger scope. but tying into what Brandon says, diffusion, keyword here. The real seriousness of the issue coming from the outside, not being American, is this one. Follow the logic here. Number one, the American dream is dead. Number two, that's a death penalty for that one. Social lynch mob is going to come after. Social media lynch mob is going to come after you for that one. Okay, there you go. Now, number two, Trump versus Clinton is prophetic, meaning that the division of America today with 50% against the other 50% is going to stay for a long time to come. Number three, the internet's going to provide recipes for building bombs and putting them on drones within the next 5 to 10 years on a massive scale, meaning that both hipsters in Portland, Oregon, and probably quite a few pissed off kids in West Virginia will build bombs. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is the most likely scenario for the United States for the next 15 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's going to create enormous amounts of violence. Smaller groups of violence certainly will be called terrorism on a large scale. And that kind of chaos has only had one response in history, and that response has always been authoritarianism. And suddenly a lot of Americans are going to think that the Chinese Communist Party isn't maybe such a bad idea. So if you look at it, say, 20, 30 years from now, and we talk about digital revolution, yes, we're all going to benefit from all these things that, you know, make our lives real lot easier. The middlemen are disappearing everywhere. Cost and benefit is enormous in this. But the real problem here is that digital, with its massive memory of every act every human being ever did, currently it's more like I got drunk when I was 15, and suddenly I get sentenced to death when I'm 60 for being drunk when I was 15. You know, social media lynch mobs are doing exactly that at the moment. But that sort of unforgiving, huge Freudian superego injunction that digital is becoming now is something we're going to have to live with and learn to live with the next 20, 30 years until we finally can get to grips with it. But I think the real threat here is either America going towards a civil war or authoritarianism. And I don't see any third alternative unless some Americans start to have that debate now, because that's what digital is going to do to this country. That's my prophecy.
Yikes. Okay. So we need somebody from outside the country to freak us out like that. But I will say, so this is a good point in time to start the questions, and I have one that's directly relevant that came to us through the computer system. But I also want folks to know that we have the cards going around. So I'm just going to start with them, but please
we'll trust the cards more than the computer.
Exactly. The questions were from China, I think. How realistic to think that we can adopt regulations or legislation to rein in data, as the title of this session suggests, when data is so very fluid? Stump the chumps.
I'm not, all right. Sure, I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to rein in data. It's very hard, you know, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it doesn't go back in very easily. But I do think that we can create regulations that about data ownership. Apparently, someone doesn't like it when I'm talking.
It's the tone bearer.
So that would be my. I think getting rid of, you know, the fact that there's a lot of data out there, not going to happen. There is a lot of data out there.
I would add that if I've got data and I'm somewhere in America and you finally, after 15 years through Congress, have some legislation to control the data that I collected, I probably by that time, long ago, would have put it somewhere else. I would have left America and put it outside of America. I work with Google already, and they put tons and tons and tons of data outside of American territory, meaning American legislators have no access to it and can't do anything about it. The Internet Protocol is a global empire. I wrote a book called that, 2003. Okay. I said the Internet Protocol in itself is a technological empire. It means it's global in scope, meaning if I got data or anything else valuable that's digital, I can move it to anywhere I like, whenever I like, and it doesn't cost me a penny. That means the Congress of America will have nothing to say in all of this. Silicon Valley is already way more powerful than Washington, D.C., and I think America has to wake up to that.
Yeah, I mean, the Cambridge Analytica scandal actually went from 300,000 records to several billion due to a change in Facebook policy that was pre-2015. It happened, you know, just a couple years ago, primarily because data that was stashed that had been taken off those servers. So I guess I'm just reinforcing the fact that the data is out there, it's out there, but the use of the data, I do think, as I mentioned earlier, there's a place to for policy to rein that in, and GDPR is a reasonable start in Europe, and I think the U.S. needs to follow suit.
So I'm going to go with a question from a card here, and it's a long question, so I'm going to try to summarize it. Hopefully I get it sufficiently correct. So Brandon mentioned the notion, actually I think it was Alex who mentioned this, the notion of empowering selected tribes. And he is using data collection for real causes that deeply impact community. So the thought is, how do we disseminate education and the resources for real people, like, I think in this instance, Brandon, to use that as a tool for addressing these real challenges that society faces.
Can you repeat that question again?
Sure. So the idea is that we're talking about the negative consequences and individual use of data, but then I think Alex brought up the notion of tribes coming together and being empowered to address social issues. How do we give society and tribes the power to use technology?
I think that there's a fundamental, I have a fundamental discrepancy in, I think that the world has a fundamental discrepancy in that approach. Because people who need to be in power often don't have the accessibility or resources to be there, right? So if we're talking about, let's say, for instance, Alex talked a bit about Silicon Valley, and I live in Oakland, which is about, 20 minutes outside of Silicon Valley, and it is just a bunch of white, young, straight guys building Snapchat in various different ways that they can do that, and that's great because I like Snapchat. But it doesn't actually solve the world's problems or the problems that are problems to me, right? And so what would the world look like if 13-year-old or 30-year-old black women were building technology for the world today? How much better would our lives be, right? And so I think that while it's important, and I hear the comment around making sure that we build these robust tribes so that we can have technology and resources at our disposal to create the world we want, I think that that's great. But I don't necessarily think that we can do that without putting people who have and experience the greatest problems and pain in the world in positions of power with resources at their disposal.
Brandon, I work with those girls, but they live in Nairobi and Lagos. That's where it's happening. Come with me to Africa. They're great. Young black girls building tech. They're all over Africa.
Yeah. On that note, thanks for pointing that, actually, because I have a question for you, Mr. Uber.
That would be Greg.
I'm sorry, Greg. I'm just joking. About half of the experiences, about half the times where people are involuntarily interacting with police is when they're being pulled over. The people who spend the most time on the road, first, is truck drivers, and second, are Uber drivers. I think that that's a great opportunity for Uber to engage and lean into this issue, because when I was building Raheem, I actually was an Uber driver for 2 years, funny enough, and I was a part of a community of like 20,000 Facebook members who were Uber drivers.
Yeah.
And time after time, they got pulled over by police officers. And we would all report our experiences in Facebook about like the shitty service from police. But I think that would be a great opportunity for Uber to use its power and its leverage for mobile devices. Because every Uber driver and Uber rider has to use their mobile device to either get a ride or give a ride. It'd be a great opportunity in collaboration with Uber and Raheem to begin reporting those experiences in real time so that we can collect the data. And it would actually not only be helpful for Raheem and advancing the logic of better policing.
I think it might also be helpful for the maps you're building. What, how great would it be for us to demonstrate around the world how some drivers are able to navigate freely throughout streets in West Virginia, and how some of us are pulled over more frequently than others in the rough streets of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And so I posit that not as a, you know, more of like a rhetorical, but I'd love to see how big companies, not just Uber, but bigger companies around the world are responding to real problems that are happening to those who aren't necessarily in power.
Yeah.
But you don't need the big company for that.
I don't.
No, you can start that. I mean, that's what's happening already. I'm sure there are already Uber drivers creating their own subcultures. That's what I talk about, subcultures. Stopping individuals, start operating in groups, and have staying power. Don't do Occupy Wall Street. That's just an Instagram picture, 3 days in the road in a T-shirt, and off you go, and Wall Street laugh their heads off. Okay, that won't work. Sustainable stuff is built by building subcultures that last for years, and they have staying power. It's called unions in the past, right? So I'm sure you don't need Uber for that. It's better if the Uber drivers themselves self-organize and do exactly that by understanding the power of their own mobile cameras. And then off you go. That's exactly what you do, by the way, Brandon. More of that.
It is what I do.
Yeah.
Greg, did you want to comment?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great idea. And, you know, Uber has made a lot of proactive changes recently with drivers and safety kit and tracking. And I'd love to talk about it more. Obviously, I'm not a representative of Uber on this stage. I'm representing myself. But I wholly support it.
And I'm with the chamber, and I'm all about networking, so you guys connect after cards. I'm going to ask one other question for a quick answer, because I just find this one intriguing. Will the efforts of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks be more or less important in the future? Is information transparency a desirable trait of a digital economy? Please, Alex.
I work with WikiLeaks. I work with Julian. Julian is a bit of a fuck-off, but I love him to bits, okay? Really tough childhood in Australia. But somebody far less complex is a real hero to me is Edward Snowden. And for people outside of America, Edward Snowden is a real hero, and I'll explain why. Before Edward Snowden happened, 90% of internet traffic on the planet went through American territory. And NSA employed more mathematicians than Google. And they had nothing better to do all day but to eavesdrop on the entire population of the Earth. So when Edward Snowden happened, a couple of years later, the amount of internet traffic that passes U.S. territory has fallen from 90 to 40%. And I think that's good for the rest of the world outside of America. So I love Edward Snowden, and I love Assange. And I think more of that stuff, more of that kind of civil heroism is needed. And I think we both need to face the tech giants and the Chinese Communist Party and all these guys and create these subcultures, decentralized platforms more than ever, and understand that this is going to take a lot of work from programmers and everybody else that's not going to be paid. That's why it's a spiritual exercise I'm talking about. But I think it's the most important thing we can do in the next 50 years.
Anyone else on that? No? All right, so listen, we are out of time, and that's the beauty of the Conference of World Affairs, that it leaves you hungry for more dialogue. But I, one of the panelists said, the individual is dead. But I will say that these individuals, I'm glad they're live and kicking and they're right here. So I want to thank Barrett, William, Brandon, Alexander, and Greg. Thank you so much for...